ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 30, entitled The Activities of the Prachetas, Text 24. Please repeat after me. Namo Vishuddha Sattvaya, Haraye Harimedhase, Vasudevaya Krishnaya, Prabhave Sarva Sattvata, Namaha. Obeisances. Vishuddha Sattvaya, unto you whose existence is free from all material influence. Haraye, who takes away all miserable conditions of devotees. Harimedhase, whose brain works only for the deliverance of the conditioned soul. Vasudevaya, the all-pervading Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishnaya, unto Krishna. Prabhave, who increases the influence. Sarva Sattvata, of all kinds of devotees. Translation appropriate by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Dear Lord, we offer our respectful obeisances unto you because your existence is completely independent of all material influences. Your Lordship always takes away the devotees' miserable conditions, for your brain plans how to do so. You live everywhere as Paramatma, therefore you are known as Vasudeva. You also accept Vasudeva as your father, and you are celebrated by the name Krishna. You are so kind that you always increase the influence of all kinds of devotees. Please repeat. Dear Lord, we offer our respectful obeisances unto you, because your existence is completely independent of all material influences. Your Lordship always takes away the Lord's miserable conditions, the devotee's miserable conditions. Krishna doesn't have any miserable conditions. For your brain plans how to do so. You live everywhere as Paramatma. Therefore, you are known as Vasudev. You also accept Vasudev as your father, and you are celebrated by the name Krishna. You are so kind that you always increase the influence of all kinds of devotees. Purport. In the previous verse, it has been said, Grihita Maya Guna Vigrahaya. The Lord accepts three kinds of bodies, Vishnu, Brahma, and Shiva, for the purposes of creating, maintaining, and annihilating the cosmic manifestation. The three predominating deities of the material universe, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, are called guna avatars. There are many kinds of incarnations of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the first incarnations within this material world are Brahma, Vishnu, and Maheshwara, Shiva. Out of these three, Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva accept material bodies. But Lord Vishnu does not accept a material body. Lord Vishnu is therefore known as Vishuddha Sattva. His existence is completely free from the contamination of the material modes of nature. One should therefore not think that Lord Vishnu is in the same category with the Lord, with Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva. The Shastras forbid us to think in this way. Yastu Narayanam Devam Brahma Rudradi Daivatai Samatte Naiva Viksheta sapashandi bhavedhruvam. One who considers Lord Vishnu to be in the same category with the devas, like Lord Brahma or Lord Shiva, or thinks Lord Brahma and Shiva to be equal to Lord Vishnu, is to be considered as pashandi, a faithless non-believer. Therefore, in this verse, Lord Vishnu is distinguished in the words Namo Vishuddha Sattvaya. Although living entity like us, Lord Brahma is exalted due to his pious activities. Therefore, he is given the highest post of Brahma. Lord Shiva is not actually like a living entity, but he is not the Supreme Personality of Godhead. His position is somewhere between Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and Brahma, the living entity. Lord Shiva is therefore explained in Brahma Samhita 5.45 in this way. Kshiram yathadha divikara vishesha yogat sanjayate nahitata pritagasti heto yashambhutama pitatha samupaitya karyat govindamadi purusham tamaham bhajami. Lord Shiva is considered to be like yogurt, dadhi. Yogurt is nothing but transformed milk. Nonetheless, yogurt cannot be accepted as milk. Similarly, Lord Shiva holds almost all the powers of Lord Vishnu, and he is also above the qualities of the living entity. But he is not exactly like Vishnu, just as yogurt, although transformed milk is not exactly like milk. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is also described herein as Vasudevaya Krishnaya. Krishna is the original Supreme Personality of Godhead, and all Vishnu expansions are his plenary portions, or portions of his plenary portions, known as Svangsha and Kala. This purport is very long, so bear with me. This Svangsha, or direct expansion, is also called Angsha. All Vishnu tattvas are Svangsha, direct parts and parcels of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. Krishna is known as Vasudev because he appeared in this material world as a son of Vasudev. Similarly, he is known as Devaki Nandana, Yashoda Nandana, Nanda Nandana, and so on. Again and again, the Lord is very much interested in increasing the influence of his devotees. Therefore, he is described herein as Prabhave Sarva Sattvatam. The Sattvata community is a community of Vaishnavas, pure devotees of the Lord. The Supreme Personality of Godhead has unlimited powers, and he wants to see that his devotees are also entrusted with unlimited powers. A devotee of the Lord is always, therefore, distinguished from all other living entities. The word Hari means one who takes away all miserable conditions, and Hari Medhasa means that the Lord is always planning ways to deliver the conditioned soul from the clutches of Maya. The Lord is so kind that he personally incarnates to deliver the conditioned souls. And whenever he comes, he makes his plans. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya cha duskritam dharma sangsthapanarthaya sambhavami yuge yuge. To deliver the pious and to annihilate the miscreants, as well as to re-establish the principles of religion, I advent myself millennium after millennium. Bhagavad Gita 4.8. Since the Lord delivers all conditioned souls from the clutches of Maya, he is known as Hari Medhas. In the list of incarnations, Krishna is described as the supreme and original personality of Godhead. Ete chang sakala punsa krishnastu bhagavan svayam indriyari vyakulam lokam mridayanti yuge yuge. Krishna, the original personality of Godhead, appears in this material world when the demigods, who are devotees of the Lord, are disturbed by the demons. Om Gyanam Timiranthasya Gyananjana Shilakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Svapadantikam Vanchakalpatarubhyasya Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. I'll read the verse one more time. Namo Vishuddha Sattvaya Haraye Hari Medhase Vasudevaya Krishnaya Prabhave Sarva Sattvatam. So this is a continuation, obviously, from the previous verse. And this verse is very beautiful. It's describing the Lord as Vishuddha Sattva. Namo Vishuddha Sattvaya. So in the previous verse, I'll just read it for context. The Prachetas were saying, I think it's the Prachetas. The Prachetas were saying to the Lord, "Dear Lord, we beg to offer our obeisances unto you. When the mind is fixed upon you, the world of duality, although a place for material enjoyment, appears meaningless. Your transcendental form is full of transcendental bliss. We therefore offer our respectful obeisances unto you. Your appearances as Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and Lord Vishnu are meant for the purposes of creating, maintaining, and annihilating this cosmos." So in this text, they point out how the Lord appears in the form of the gunas. So he appears as each one of the gunas. So as Brahma, he appears in the mode of passion, as Shiva in the mode of ignorance, and as Vishnu in the mode of goodness. Now, one thing that we learn in this philosophy, in Srila Prabhupada's books, is that the Lord is above the modes of nature. Right? He's transcendental to the modes of nature. So how is it that the Lord can appear within the gunas? So the point then that they make here in this verse is that and also in the previous verse, here they're further emphasizing it, is that when the Lord appears, then he appears as a mode of goodness. Right? So the Lord is above the gunas, but there's no harm or no problem in the Lord appearing in the mode of goodness, because he is Vishnu, the mode of goodness. Here in this purport, Prabhupada is talking about Maya, this whole concept, of this idea of Krishna's Maya. So Maya is Krishna's power, as we know. And generally we understand Maya as elusive power, the power which keeps us in this material world, it keeps us bound. But this is just one aspect of Maya. Maya actually exists in the spiritual world. Yes, the spiritual world is full of Maya. So we have no freedom from Maya. But that Maya is only composed of goodness, right, of pure goodness. And the entire spiritual world, Krishna's form and Krishna's abode, are all made of pure goodness. This world, we say the very basic elements of these worlds are the gunas, goodness, passion, ignorance. And it's a combination of these three gunas that produce all the variety, everything within this world. So similarly, in the spiritual world, the mode of goodness produces all this variety. It produces Krishna's abode, Krishna's form even. Krishna's form is a manifestation of his Maya. So many times in the Bhagavatam, and it's sometimes so confusing, you read that Krishna, his form is composed of Maya. And this is like Mayavad philosophy, isn't it? You think, wow, this is Mayavad philosophy. Or we read Krishna's, all of his pastimes are enacted through his Maya. So, because of Shankaracharya, Maya is taken now as a negative force, as something bad. Yes, it has that aspect. Even in that aspect, it's not exactly bad. But actually, Maya simply means the power of the Lord. So Krishna is always accompanied with his power, and his power is always accompanying Krishna. They're inseparable. So this is called Yoga Maya, or sometimes short, Maya. And all of the spiritual world, everything, and this Maya is composed of the mode of goodness. And the entire spiritual world is composed of the mode of goodness. And then when that mode of goodness becomes mixed with passion and ignorance, then it becomes a problem. Then that Maya is engaging us or binding us to this material world. So therefore, if we separate the mode of passion and the mode of ignorance from the mode of goodness, then Krishna, the Lord Vasudev, he appears as the mode of goodness. He's Vishuddha Sattva. And therefore, because he's free from all passion and all ignorance, he's pure goodness, Vishuddha Sattva. And so there's a famous Satvam Vishuddham Vasudeva Sarvitam. That who is Vasudeva? Vasudeva is Satvam Vishuddham Vasudeva Sarvitam. That he's not just any sattva, because the problem in calling Krishna goodness is that the goodness in this world is always mixed with some passion and ignorance. It's always mixed. It's actually not separable from these other three modes. But when it becomes free of these other modes, then it becomes Vishuddha Sattva, or pure goodness. And that is the Supreme Lord. So this is Krishna's Maya. That Krishna, by his Maya, he appears, he manifests these three forms as Vishnu, Brahma, and Shiva in the material world. But in the spiritual world, he and his Maya, or everything, are pure goodness. They're pure bliss. So here, this Prabhupada is developing on the same point about the nature of the Lord, how therefore we should not confuse Lord Vishnu with other demigods, because even though he's also, you could say, one of the gunas, but he can never be compared to Shiva, Lord Shiva, or to Lord Shiva or Lord Brahma. And as we may remember, that's one of the offenses against the holy name. The second offense is to consider the names of Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma to be equal to or independent of the names of Lord Vishnu. So now, along with this, the Prachetas make a very nice point. They say that you are a pure goodness, you are Vishuddha Sattva, and therefore they call him Hari. Right? They call him Hari. And the name of the Lord, Hari, I learned this when I got initiated, because my name is Gopal Hari. So the Hari means one who takes away distresses, one who removes the distresses of his devotees. So because Krishna is pure goodness, right, he alone, Lord Vishnu alone, Krishna alone, has the power to remove people's distress. Right? So Brahma and Shiva, if we worship them, they can give us some very wonderful material benedictions. They can give us so much material prosperity, so many material opulences. But these opulences will ultimately turn into distress. So it'll actually get worse. You know, they actually in some ways give distress if they're giving these material opulences. But in the case of Lord Vishnu, because he's pure goodness, he's all good, he removes this distress from the Lord. He removes distress from his devotees so that they become situated in pure goodness and pure happiness themselves. So this is very significant, because sometimes we may wonder, is Krishna or is the Lord good or not, right? Sometimes based on our experience in this life or something we may read in the scriptures, we may wonder, is Krishna good or not? Is God good or not? This is not only in our own philosophy, but in all the religions of the world, they ask this question. Or sometimes we may just be worried about that, you know, is Krishna, is he going to be nice to me if I worship him? Is he pure, you know, very good? Because sometimes he seems acts in a very difficult way towards the devotees. But his very definition of the Lord is pure goodness. So anything, any goodness that we find in this world, whatever our conception of goodness may be, whatever you know, we feel it, someone to be a very sacrificing or wonderful person, someone we can actually identify with, that goodness is actually a manifestation of the goodness of the Lord. So so there cannot be anyone more compassionate, more kind, more wonderful and merciful than the Lord, because he is goodness itself. He is pure goodness. And so that's why we sometimes, in Krishna's pastimes, we see, right, that Krishna is enjoying, he seems like he's having the fun time, and his devotees are undergoing so many difficulties. And this is a fact, actually. I used to actually sometimes feel a little angry at Krishna, because it always seemed like, you know, he was playing the flute and having this wonderful time, and his devotees were the ones who were always going through so much problems. And also, I mean, his devotees seem to have the qualities that we aspire for, but he always seemed to just be a sense enjoyer, really. You know, just in every way, enjoying his senses. He's always in a pleasurable state. So how is he? You know, how is he? One could say that person who someone would want to surrender themselves to. So the Lord, even though he is, or because he is situated in this state of pure happiness, in the state of pure pleasure, then he's also the most compassionate. He's also the most merciful. And everything that he is doing to us and to his devotees is a manifestation of that compassion, is a manifestation of that goodness. And therefore, he has nothing, you know, he's ever blissful as well. We may be at his conditioned souls, we may be envious of him, but he has no reason not to be happy, because he is the most good, he is the most wonderful. If there's any unhappiness, it is due to our own shortcoming. So we've been saying, so here it said that the Lord removes the distresses of his devotees. This point here is being described in Prabhupada's purport as one of his specific qualities. But in some sense, and I've been sort of mixing up these words, that the Lord removes the distress of the Lord. Right? But in some sense, the Lord or the devotees remove the distress of the Lord as well. So this is actually a very wonderful point, that in the Gita, Krishna says, in one of these last verses, that one who spreads this message to others, right, this person is most dear, and no one else is more dear to me. And he says, Nachata smat manishyeshu kashchid yatatvisiddhate yatatam api siddhanam kashchid mam viti tatvata. That person who gives this knowledge to others is most dear, and no one else is more dear, and that person is the most dear to me. So one may ask, why is this? Why is Krishna saying this? This is a very serious statement. He's making a very serious point. So one reason is because Krishna is genuinely concerned about us. Right? His concern for us is greater than his concern for himself. So those who are giving this knowledge to others and thus removing their distress, they're doing, in his eyes, they're doing a greater service than those who are directly serving him or worshipping him or offering him praise. Because he could say that those who offer me worship, they're the most dear. Like, but this, he is saying, this is the best form of worship, because he's concerned about the misery of other living entities more than his own worship. So this is one reason why. Another reason is also because when the conditioned soul turns away from the Lord, then it's not that only we are, you could say, experiencing distress as a result of separation from the Lord. Of course, our distress is due to forgetfulness of the Lord. But it's also that Krishna is experiencing distress from being separated from his devotees. From his devotee who is now in this material world. So we know in the spiritual world how there's this rasa of separation, right? The Lord and separation. The Lord feels separation from his devotees. It's called viraha bhakti, and it's the highest form of devotion. So this we see manifest amongst the different residents of the spiritual world. But when the soul leaves the spiritual world, then it's not that Krishna forgets about that soul, or it's like, oh, well, too bad he's gone. I hope to see him back soon. But no, he's actually feeling great distress from being separated from his devotee, who's now forgotten him, who's now left him. And so therefore, and this is one of Krishna's, this is really his only distress, Right? Krishna has nothing else to be sorry for. He has everything else. He has all the sweet rice he wants. He has all the garlands that he wants. So he has everything else. But this is really his only distress, that he's feeling separated from his devotee. And no one can replace our, you could say, role in the spiritual world. It's not that if there's millions or billions of souls, so if we leave, hardly anyone notices. There's immediately someone to take up our service. No, that service is not being fulfilled toward the Lord. So Krishna is actually feeling that separation and is missing that service that only we can perform towards the Lord. And so bringing souls back to Krishna is removing Krishna's distress. It's removing this distress of the Lord. And therefore, if someone does that, he feels very grateful. He feels, oh wow, this person has been so kind to me. He's brought my devotee back to me. He's removed this distress from my heart. So therefore, the Lord, he himself, after every millennium, in every time, Prabhupada says he's so merciful that he appears in every millennium, and he delivers conditioned souls himself, right? He has so many incarnations. It's said they're as numerous as the waves of the ocean. So he comes himself and he delivers all the different living entities from the clutches of Maya, and he also engages his devotees in doing this. And the devotees themselves engage themselves in doing this activity because this, they know, pleases the Lord the most. It removes his separation from the Lord. So, this is the Lord's, you could say, feeling, or the Lord's compassion or mercy, that we may not feel separation from the Lord, but he is always feeling separation from the living entity who's in the material world. So, I did this in my Bhakti Shasti class also, but since most of those people are not here who are there, a few are, but I was recently writing a paper on why the Lord gives distress to his devotees. Because here it says that the Lord gives distress to his devotees. It takes away distress from his devotees. But, sorry, I slept very little last night, so I'm just, but the point is that he takes away distress from his devotees, but he's also the one who's giving the distress, right? We should not miss that point. In the sense that Krishna's a little tricky, in the sense that he first of all gives the distress, and then he comes about, and then he takes away that distress away. So then the devotee feels very, very grateful to the Lord. But in some ways, ultimately, everything is coming from the Lord, right? So he's the one who's putting the devotee in that situation. Now, of course, he's giving that because we need it. In a sense, in some ways, we are the cause, because there's something lacking in the devotee, or something the devotee needs to learn or something, therefore he's giving that distress. But ultimately, still he's the one who's giving it. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has written some very nice things on this point of the Lord giving distress to his devotees. So I thought I will read that for you. And it's on the section of the Bhagavatam, which is the section of Maharaj Yudhishthira. When Maharaj Yudhishthira goes to Bhishma Dev, and this is after the battle of Kurukshetra, and he's feeling very distraught because he's lost everything. All the Pandavas, they their own children, their five powerful sons, who were who were equivalent to the Pandavas, they were killed in the battlefield of Kurukshetra. All their friends and relatives were killed in the battlefield of Kurukshetra, and even their grandson was barely saved by the Lord. So their distress is greater than the distress that any of us may experience in our life. Right? It's far, far beyond the distress that we may experience. So therefore, they're a very good example for devotees, because, I mean, they sort of set the standard. We can't complain that we have a distress greater than them. So he's going to Bhishma Dev and asking him to please help him get out of this lamentation. also it's double sided. Okay. 4, 5, 6. So in Radhadesh, when I come, I'm generally writing here. So I thought, since the devotees have been so kind to me and provided me such a wonderful atmosphere, I thought I'll share something that I was writing here. So this is Maharaj Yudhishthira coming, and this is here. He says, so the Bhagavatam, there's no doubt that the Bhagavatam accords significance to the doctrine of karma. So it says, yes, karma is one of the causes of suffering. But the Bhagavatam contends that all karma one performs in each lifetime adds to the overall progress of the living beings. But it does not see karma as an adequate solution to the problem of suffering. It admits that just as it is difficult or sometimes impossible to ascertain the cause of a forest fire, which may be due to lightning or the rubbing of sticks, so also the cause of living entities obtaining and relinquishing physical bodies is difficult to fathom. In particular, the Purana ponders what John Boker calls the Hindu problem of job. In other words, this is the problem of why the righteous are suffering. Why are the devotees suffering? The Bhagavatam commences with the last section of the Mahabharata, which deals extensively with the problem of suffering. After the battle of Kurukshetra is over, Yudhishthira is in a state of unbearable distress, overcome by guilt, regret, and loss, and finding no happiness in the kingdom he has just won. Accompanied by sages, his brothers, and Krishna, Yudhishthira proceeds to the battlefield to seek consolation from Bhishma, who is lying mortally wounded on a bed of arrows. Indeed, all the survivors of the terrible battle were distraught by the great loss of life. But the Bhagavatam specifically highlights the suffering of Yudhishthira because he was a son of Dharma, the very embodiment of righteousness. Surely the Pandavas, who understood all the intricacies of Dharma and lived by them, were the least deserving of suffering. The Purana expresses this sentiment in the words of Bhishma, who shows deep concern for the plight of the Pandavas. O sons of Dharma, alas, how painful, how much unjust, you who have resorted to the Brahmanas, religious duties, and Achyuta, Krishna, do not deserve to live such a miserable life. So Bhishadev here, he's making this very point, that devotee suffering cannot be due to karma. The Pandavas' suffering could not be due to their karma, because they've always lived their life by the directions of Krishna. So he's starting out like this. He's saying, how unjust is your suffering? Because I cannot see that this is due to karma. The Pandavas had undergone immense suffering. As children, they lost their father and were harassed by their uncle and cousins. Their wife was humiliated, and they were banished to the forest for 14 years. In the end, they lost all their children, dear friends, relatives, and teachers in the battle. Their mother, Kunti, lost her husband at a young age and raised 5 children on her own. Bhishma rejects the idea that the Pandavas' distress is a product of their past karma. Indeed, throughout the Bhagavatam's narrative, the Pandavas' good character and spotless reputation are emphasized. Here Bhishma points out that although the Pandavas always lived righteously, they nevertheless had to undergo immense distress. How could so much injustice affect faultless persons? The doctrine of karma makes a person singularly responsible for his or own fate. Bhishma, however, rejects such an unyielding view of human suffering and begins to ponder other causes of suffering. So then he says, okay, karma cannot be the cause. So what could be other causes? What could be other reasons why they're suffering? Bhishma suggests that time may be responsible for Yudhishthira's suffering. Quote, and I think that whatever unpleasant has happened to you, the Pandavas, is brought about by time, Kala, under whose influence lies the entire world, along with its guardians of the quarters of the world, just as a row of clouds under the control of the wind. In the Bhagavatam, time plays a very important role. By his own power, Krishna appears in this world as time. In the 10th book, Krishna is referred to as Purusha Kala, time in the form of the Supreme Person, who wars both death and immortality. And I'll skip a little bit here. The wheel of time acts on those who are not devoted to Krishna and is death for the sinful. However, time does not act on the liberated souls who enter the state of immortality and thus transcend the barrier of time. Numerous narratives in the Bhagavatam show that the devotees of Krishna are unaffected by time and death. Dhruva is a prime example of such a devotee. When death approaches him at the end of his life, Dhruva uses death's head as a footstool to board an airplane to his abode, the pole star. Vishnu resides in Dhruva's planet and thus it is deathless. Undoubtedly, Yudhishthira was a dear devotee and relative of Krishna. So how could time affect him? In the very next verse, Bhishma himself recognizes this problem by asking, so how does time not affect a devotee? How does time not affect a devotee? Why is time not a cause of his suffering? Time affects a devotee, so how does time cannot be the cause of his distress? I'm almost done. Yes. Yes, but he still dies, right? And he still gets old. And well, yes. Sorry, please. Yes, go ahead. Okay. Material time. Okay, so yes, he's transcendental to material time. And so exactly how does that manifest? Do you also have a comment? That's a good point. And how does that manifest then? Yes, that's nice. Time acts on matter, right? It acts on the body and it acts on the material mind. Because the devotee does not identify with the body or the mind, therefore time doesn't affect him. Because he's no longer living in the body. So he has a body, but if you're not this body, if he knows that and he's realized that, then time doesn't affect him because it's only affecting the body. So in this way, the devotees are above time and they transcend time. So Bhishmadev rejects time, and then he's rejected karma as a cause of the Pandava suffering. So ultimately, he realizes that the only cause of the Pandava suffering can be their friend, Krishna, who's standing right next to them. So then he turns to Krishna. These double-sided pages are really confusing. 10, 9, 10, okay. Thus, the Bhagavatam speaks of Daiva. Okay, as we have seen, Bhishma rejects karma and time as possible causes for Yudhishthira's suffering. And so the prime possibility here is the will of God. Since God himself was always accompanying Yudhishthira, only he could be the cause, ultimate cause of Yudhishthira's suffering. In the next verse, Bhishma implicitly implicates Krishna. O king, nobody really could divine the intentions of this Krishna. As a matter of fact, even learned persons who try with a desire to fathom it become perplexed. Thus, Bhishma uses three terms to identify the cause of Yudhishthira's suffering: Kala, Karma, and Bhagavan, and all three point to Krishna. Bhishma indicates that no matter how much one tries to understand the plan of God, who is supremely independent, it is impossible. Even though great philosophers inquire exhaustively, they are bewildered. Bhishma points out that since it is Bhagavan's Maya which deludes the entire world, his plan is unknowable. At this point in Bhishma's soliloquy, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, who is commenting on this verse, raises a pertinent question. Since Krishna was actually present before Bhishma and the Pandavas, why did they simply not ask the Lord about his plan? So now the question comes up, okay, so the devotee's suffering cannot be due to karma, it cannot be due to time, it is given by the Lord. So then, why did the Lord give them this suffering? We've identified the cause, but why did he do this? Vishwanatha responds as follows. Even if asked by Bhishma, the Lord will not speak, but instead will evade him. Even if he, the Lord, says something, he still bewilders everyone. Therefore, his plan is to be followed, but is not subject to inquiry. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur goes on to say that Krishna confuses everyone, particularly by his oblique speech. In the 11th book, Krishna announces that even the Vedas speak elusively and answer questions indirectly. The Vedic seers and mantras deal in esoteric terms, and I am pleased by such confidential topics. Nevertheless, Vishwanath admits that no one can understand or interfere with the plan of Krishna, that even though no one can understand or interfere with the plan of Krishna, one is still drawn to inquire. Then he says, but inquiry is necessary. Does Krishna want to give us suffering, or does he want to give us joy? Does he want to give us suffering and happiness? It cannot be the first, because his quality of being affectionate to his devotees would be cancelled. So Krishna cannot be wanting to give us suffering, because his quality of affection to his devotee would be cancelled. It cannot be the second, because we have not seen any happiness. It cannot be the third option, because that would be a contradiction to his kind nature. It is finally decided that no one can solve this problem by inquiry. Although no one can know the plan of the Lord, Bhishma urges one to accept that plan when it unfolds, because his plan is perfect. There never has been any change in his, Krishna's mind, for acts performed by him, who is the soul of all, who is impartial, without a second, free from pride, and free from all sins. Bhishma is confident that although the Lord may cause distress, he always acts for the benefit of all, and especially for the benefit of his pure-hearted devotees. So I'll stop here because you're probably falling asleep. Yes. So this is actually what Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's point here is that he says this, right? He's saying it very. Even if asked by Bhishma, the Lord will not speak, but instead will evade him. Even if he, the Lord, says something, he still bewilders everyone. Therefore, his plan is to be followed, but is not subject to inquiry. This is the answer that's given, and that's often given in different other religions of the world as well, that the reason why we're suffering is because we do not know. No one knows the plan of the Lord. No one knows the plan of God. But his plan is perfect, and so his plan is good, and so therefore we accept it. Now the difference, however, is that for example, in Christianity, this is the case with all living beings, right? Everyone, it's like, well, we don't know why we're suffering, but God has a good reason, and so this is the plan of the Lord. In the case of the Bhagavatam, this is only applied to the devotees of the Lord. This is only in the case of the Lord's very dear devotees. In the general case, we understand that, yes, our suffering is due to our own mistakes, is due to karma, it's due to the reactions of past activities. But in the case of devotees, we cannot come and say that, oh, Prabhu, you're suffering because of your bad karma. And even in general, we cannot say that. I mean, even though the philosophy may say that. But especially in the case of devotees, we cannot. So therefore, the devotee is facing distress due to some due to some reason that's determined by the Lord. Because Krishna has some way that he's bringing that devotee closer to him. He's bringing him nearer to him through his by giving this them this this distress. So the answer actually goes on. I'll go ahead and read it for you. It says, by giving temporary distress, Krishna frees his devotees from the actual cause of distress, namely their forgetfulness of God. Suffering drives a righteous person to remember and take refuge in God. That remembrance forever frees the devotee from repeated birth and death in this world. The Bhagavatam seems so convinced about the liberating purpose or the positive purpose of suffering that it even portrays devotees asking God for more suffering. And who is this? Queen Kunti, yes. After the Kurukshetra battle, Queen Kunti, the mother of the Pandavas, who witnessed the demise of her entire dynasty, asked Krishna for this rather unconventional benediction. May calamities befall us at every step, O teacher of the world, for it is in adversity that we are blessed with your sight, which eliminates the possibility of our seeing another birth and death. Calamities serve as a useful aid in helping Queen Kunti become free from temporary material attachments, so she can constantly remember the Lord. Right? She's reasoning in this way. Then she says, may my mind be constant and firm in devotion to you, and be not attached to any object, just as the stream of the Ganges flows into the sea. Gange bogham udanmati. So Queen Kunti, she wants to constantly remember the Lord. She wants her mind to rush to the Lord like rivers rush to the ocean. And she, the only way she sees this happening, the only solution that she sees to actually make this happen is if Krishna gives her distress. Because through these distresses, she's saying that if it means, she's saying, not that she wants distress, but she's saying that if it means that this is the only way, then let there be distress. Let there be some distress. And in that way, I'll come to you. I'll remember you. So the point here is that Krishna gives the devotee some temporary distress, the distress for a temporary period of time, so that they can ultimately become free of the cause of their distress, which is their forgetfulness of him. So that... that distress is a manifestation of his mercy. And that's ultimately the justification of distress, that how distress can exist in the presence of a Lord who's all good and all powerful, is that the distress is temporary. Because it's temporary, therefore it can have a higher cause. It's temporary distress for a better purpose. You know, temporarily, you know, the parent may punish the child, or the government may punish a citizen. But that doesn't mean that they become bad. Why? Because just by that short-term distress, that devotee starts to remember the Lord. So one time Prabhupada said this to one disciple who asked him about this very same question. He says, he asked why devotees are facing difficulties. And Prabhupada said that the devotee can take solace in the fact that this is the last birth where he'll have to experience suffering. I will have to experience difficulty. So yes, I know it's but yes, it's the last birth like this. Yes. According to the level of advancement. Yes. So, for some time, until the devotee is fully purified, suffering is there. I'll read one quote from Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur from the 10th canto. Where are you referring from? He says, the practice of bhakti, when the devotee's love for Krishna and other living beings is constant and selfless, they experience limitless and unending happiness. And Krishna becomes controlled by their affection. He chooses to serve them as he did in the case of the Pandavas. Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur states that Krishna's first expression of mercy bears the fruit of tormenting pain. His second wave of mercy causes an extraordinary shower of sweet bhakti rasa to rain down on his devotees, and Krishna promises that I give mercy in the form of my very self. So, like you're saying, so it's such a nice point that you're saying, is that Krishna has two waves of his mercy, and the first mercy is tormenting pain, and the second mercy is once that the devotee sort of goes through that, then he gets an extraordinary shower of sweet bhakti rasa to fall down on. Definitely to some degree with kala. So until we don't fully transcend the bodily concept, then kala, for example, takes the form of the pain of death, right? Because all of us die, right? And that pain of death is not due to karma. It's not that in our past life we've perform some murder and that's why every person is dying. No, that's just due to kala, that's the nature of this world. So if, until the devotees, until we're fully purified, if we're identifying with the body, we'll experience pain due to kala, due to time. But it's mainly due to the specific arrangement of the Lord. So it may be due to karma, but Krishna fine-tunes that karma in such a way that it's very, specifically helping the devotee in a specific way, and just on this point also, and as we advance, Krishna, if this distress is coming from Krishna, then Krishna gives that distress to the degree that the devotee is able to handle it. So, we read how the Pandavas, they lost their children in the battlefield of Kurukshetra. So even though all this was there, you know, all this explanation was there, I still used to feel a little bit bad that, you know, the Krishna, you know, why did Krishna do this to the Pandavas? You know, like you know, these Pandavas, they're so righteous and so one. Like how could this happen? You know, that they lose, that you know, their five children were beheaded at the end of the battlefield. I mean, it didn't have to happen. Why did Krishna need to do this like this? But we need to realize that these souls are on a completely different level. They're far more exalted and are a different level of consciousness than we are. So just a few days ago, my question was answered. I was reading the CC, and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is speaking to the Lord, to Lord Chaitanya. And Lord Chaitanya is about to leave him and go on his tour. And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, the devotees are begging the Lord to stay because they can't bear separation from him. So the Bhattacharya is saying to the Lord that I would even prefer losing my own child than to have separation from you. You see? So the point is that these devotees are so advanced that they're not on the material platform of affection or these material affection anymore, and the Lord has become so dear to them that Krishna is the dearest relationship that they have, and all other relationships are in some ways dependent upon that, and they are fulfilled within Krishna. So many times Krishna is described as the soul of all living entities, right? The gopis, they refer to Krishna that we can come and dance with you and leave our husbands because you are actually our husbands. You are the soul of all living entities. Because Krishna is the basis of everything, comes from him, everything is part of him. So if we have Krishna and if we're loving Krishna, then we have everyone else. We find satisfaction, or we can find happiness in I mean, the devotee is fully, absorbed in love for Krishna. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Krishna's distress will always be there, you're saying, right? According to our philosophy, there will always be souls in the material world, but no soul will always be in the material world. So ultimately every soul comes back. So in Krishna's distress, like in his separation, that distress is not like our distress, in the sense that that distress increases love. It's a form of love. So Krishna feels that distress from the living entity, but he also knows that they're coming back. He's missing us. He's missing the devotees, but he also knows that we're coming back. So he knows that I'm missing them only for some period of time, only for a short duration of time, then they'll be back, right? So I mean, especially it's said that our whole stay in this material world, billions of kalpas, is just a moment in the spiritual world. So Krishna's missing us for a moment, and it's a good moment. I mean, it's a serious moment, but he knows that they're coming back. So therefore, he's not. Yes. Okay, last. Yes. Yes. Yes, that's the devotee's suffering is very different, and we don't know. In other words, that's why we can really only question our own suffering, right? Why is Krishna giving me this, or how can I see? How can I see this suffering? In what light should I see this suffering as a means of my advancement? But we really cannot know other people's suffering, because suffering actually exists in the mind, right? It's how we experience it. So we really don't know how the other devotees or other living entities are experiencing this suffering. So, like you're saying, for example, Haridas Thakur, externally it seems like he's suffering so much, he's being whipped. But internally the Lord is protecting him, and he's not experiencing any of these whips. His experience is very little. I mean, that's partly Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's point, is that the devotee needs to, because it's very difficult, honestly, for a devotee to just be in bliss when he's suffering, right? I mean, for most of us, it is real. In other words, we experience something. This is the mercy of the Lord, and I'm just I'm going to come closer to the Lord because of this. But the devotee can just take this as the plan of the Lord, that this I know that he is perfect, he is pure goodness, and therefore I know that his plan is perfect, and so therefore whatever I'm going through, even though in some ways I resent it, and at times I resent it, I accept it as the plan of the Lord, and And at the end, I'll come out much better. Yeah, at the end, it doesn't exist. Yeah, yeah. And so in that sense, really, evil or suffering, all these things don't exist because they're temporary. They don't exist in the sense that they're temporary. And that which is temporary has no true existence. So and we many times we experience that even in this world, is that we go through so much, but once we've gone through it, when we look back, it seems like a moment. And it just seems like a moment. So it's this similar experience for the devotee. Okay, thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Shri Prabhupada ki, Gopi Manandi.